It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll find out what a new study has to say about pushy parents. But first, Twinkies. After a Twinkie sabbatical after Hostess's bankruptcy, they're coming back to store shelves, supposedly today.
But this time they have double the shelf life, I've heard, and word is that they're smaller.
We sent producer Chris Molina on an errand to see if he could snag some for us. He failed. We cannot do an on-air Twinkie tasting. But we're wondering, is there a favorite junk food, a snack food, something you know you shouldn't eat too much of, sometimes food, I think Sesame Street calls it, that you remember from your childhood or that you can't stay away from today? Go to the Central Time Facebook page and post there. I've, Veronica, mostly kicked my zingers habit, the old Dolly Madison zingers. Yeah. Once in a while, I'll have a relapse, but it was a daily thing for a while.
But I hope you don't mind if I give a big Twinkie reveal about you live on the air.
Uh-oh.
You like to eat your Twinkies, frozen.
Cold, yeah. They're better.
To me, is bizarre.
Frozen Twinkies or refrigerated even. I don't know. There's a little more texture to them or something.
Well, how do you like to eat your Twinkies? Do you like to eat Twinkies or are they just on your not even sometimes list, never ever list?
Do they frighten you? Share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Chris didn't find a Twinkie, but I guess he found a picture of a Twinkie to put there. So that's something, I guess.
We'll take what we can get and we'll be interested to hear what you have to say about Twinkies. Is there a junk food that you've kicked the habit, like Rob has with his zingers? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. And now something lots of kids already suspect. According to new research, it turns out a significant number of parents admit to trying to live through their children.
We are talking overly invested sports dads or stage moms who want their kids to achieve what they didn't. And we'll be getting your take on this, too. You can let us know if you've ever caught yourself pushing your kids in a certain direction, maybe pushing them too hard in sports or performance or you name it, or if you were hoping they'd learn from your mistakes in the first place. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email talk@wpr.org.
And the question is, what does it mean for the kids involved, too? We'll find out more with Brad Bushman. He's a professor of communication and psychology at Ohio State University. He's the co-author of the study investigating why some parents do push their kids. Brad, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So, Brad, some parents want to live through their kids. This is what your study found. And in a way, it's so intuitive, but you've actually got evidence for this now, right?
Right. It's an age-old idea. Psychologists like Sigmund Freud said the child shall fulfill those wishful dreams which they never carried out. And Carl Jung said that parents often desire their child to compensate for everything that was left unfulfilled in their own life. But until we conducted this study, there was no empirical evidence that it was in fact true. And we found that it was true.
Well, when you hear it expressed eloquently by Jung and Freud, it almost seems like, yeah, that's a parent's right to do that. But I don't know. What do you think after your study?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure whether it's a parent's right, but some parents do it anyway, whether it's their right or not. In particular, parents who feel like they overlap with their child, that they view their child as part of themselves, as an extension of themselves. Those are the parents who are most likely to do it.
Well, tell us more about this study. How did it work?
Yeah, well, we had 73 parents, and their children were between 8 and 15 years old, and we randomly assigned them to either an experimental or control group by the flip of a coin. In the experimental group, the parents listed two ambitions that they had not been able to achieve during their lifetime, and they wrote about why those ambitions were important to them. And in the control group, they listed two ambitions their acquaintances had not been able to achieve during their lifetime and wrote about why those ambitions were important for their acquaintances. And then we had them rate whether they viewed their child as an extension of themselves. For example, some of the items on our scale was, I hope my child will achieve what I wasn't able to achieve, reach goals that I wasn't able to reach, realize ambitions that I wasn't able to realize, fulfill dreams that I wasn't able to fulfill. And we found that parents who viewed their child as an extension of themselves were more likely to transfer their unfulfilled ambitions onto their child.
What was the acquaintance part of it supposed to tell you?
Well, I think it's an important control because it allows us to see whether thinking about unfulfilled ambitions in general has this effect, or is it something about thinking about your own unfulfilled ambitions. So both parents thought about unfulfilled ambitions, but one group thought about their own unfulfilled ambitions, and the other group thought about other people's unfulfilled ambitions.
Well, let's look at those results. What did you find?
Well, we found that parents who viewed their child as an extension of themselves, the way we measured that is their circles with, in one circle is written the self, and in the other circle is written the child. And the first set of circles, there's no overlap between the self and the child. And the second set, there's just a little bit of overlap. Third set, a little bit more. Fourth set, a little bit more. Fifth, more still. Sixth, even more. And the seventh, they're almost completely overlapped. So the more overlap there is between the parent and the child, the more likely the parent is to say, I want my child to fulfill my unfulfilled dreams.
Does that happen in healthy relationships sometimes where you and, you know, maybe it's a child, maybe it's a partner, identify with yourself? I guess what I'm asking, is it necessarily unhealthy?
We don't know. And that's actually the next step. We want to examine the impact of this. Parents who believe this, how does that affect their children? Do their children feel pressured, for example, to pursue what their parents wished they had pursued in their own lives? Or do the children, do they want to fulfill their own dreams and their own goals rather than their parents? And we don't know how it affects children. We just wanted to test Jung and Freud's idea that some parents do this in the first place, and we found good evidence that they do, especially if they view the child as an important aspect of themselves rather than as an independent entity.
I guess, you know, sometimes maybe the child has to grow up and they can look back, you know, with a grown-up's eyes and see how it affected them later.
Yeah. We're currently planning to do research to test whether this has negative effects on children, but we haven't started that research yet. We just, in fact, barely published this research.
Now, you're not just talking about, you know, the parent screaming on the sidelines at a soccer match or, you know, the parent pushing their child to perform or go to Hollywood and be a star. I mean, there are sort of smaller degrees of this, aren't there?
Yeah, it's a continuous variable. We measured it on a scale from 1, strongly disagree, to 7, strongly agree, with questions, I hope my child will blank, such as achieve what I wasn't able to achieve. So it's about, you know, maybe a father who really wanted to be a good soccer player pushes his child to be the same. Or maybe a mother who wanted to excel in theater or maybe in choir pushes her daughter to do the same. So that's what we're talking about.
Well, right now we're talking about the phenomenon of parents getting overly invested in their kids and trying to live through them based on a new study. Talking now with Brad Bushman, a professor of communication and psychology at Ohio State University. And he's the co-author of the study investigating why some parents push their kids.
And we're wondering, are we telling your story here? Did your parents, do you think, push you to do something that they wish they had done better at? Were you kind of filling the gap for a perceived failure in life? Or were they pushing you to, if they were into sports, to follow their footsteps? Or do you think they gave you a good level of, I guess, autonomy to do your own thing? Or if you're a parent, flip that question around. How are you doing on these issues? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page or send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. We pick up our conversation now with Brad Bushman, and it's looking at a new study that shows some parents over-identify with their kids and try to live through them.
We're taking your calls and your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And let's take our first caller now. We have Ned joining us from Madison. Hi, Ned.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I have four young adult children between 21 and 30, and I'm still very close to all of them. We have a good time. We just all went to a concert last week together. And I'm a performer. I'm an actor and a singer. And all of them did that as they were growing up, and I gave them lots of opportunities to do that. My youngest son has the most obvious talent and has done some significant performing as a young adult, but he's not doing as much of it right now. And he's the one I think about the most because I thought, you know, he would have been good enough to be a professional by now. And he may still be a professional performer, but he isn't yet, and I'm not sure what route he's taking. And I'm trying to really stay kind of hands-off on that and let him make his decisions about that.
So over the years, as he was growing up, it sounds like you were kind of involved. You said you gave him opportunities. Was there a certain point where you said, you know what, they're adults. Now it's up to them.
I don't know. Maybe I did. I'm sure I said about the other three. He's the youngest. So, you know, he's just 21 now.
Oh, well, he's young.
Yeah, yeah. And he was going to school in Madison, but isn't anymore. And he's about to move to Chicago. So I think he's making a pretty big decision on his own right now by moving to a different big city.
Are you glad that you made the decisions that you did, Ned, with your kids?
Yeah, I'm pretty pleased with how they've turned out. And even if they're not all, you know, and none of them are professional performers, but they still do it and really like it. You know, like I said, we all went to a concert together last week, you know, where most of the people there were in their age ranges. And, you know, but
nice.
I didn't mind it all being the dad there.
All right. Sounds good. All right.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Ned. And Brad, what do you think of Ned's story?
Yeah, well, I think it's great that he's able to go to concert with his children. That's fantastic. And I think parents who have skills and talents should definitely share those and make those available to their children. What we don't know yet is whether pushing children to pursue the same goals and desires and career path you have is harmful or not. We don't know that. We know some parents are more likely to do that than others, but we don't know the effects yet.
Okay, thanks for the call, Ned. And next we go to Roger in Dodgeville. Hi, Roger.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I share the same name as my father, and he really wanted me to go into wrestling because he was a wrestler in high school, and he was the captain of the team, and I wasn't good at wrestling at all, and you know, I think I might be the only wrestler in history that would go to a tournament and say, so if I lose another match, I'm done, right? my senior year, I said, you know, I just can't do this anymore. My mom actually saw how worked up I would get going to even just practices. I just did not enjoy it. So it caused a little bit of a rift between my dad and I. But, I mean, now we're, you know, things are better. But at the time, I think it was a difficult thing for my father.
You don't sound permanently scarred. You've got a sense of humor about it. I don't know. It sounds like you wish your dad would have done it differently. But, I don't know, looking back, do you think there was any lasting harm done?
I think actually it probably made me stronger because I realized, you know, who I want to be and what I want to do. And now I have a daughter and, you know, I think to myself, okay, I'm not going to do the same things that my parents did.
You're not going to make her wrestle.
No, I'm not going to make her wrestler. So, I mean, I think it made me stronger. Made me realize what I want to do. And as a parent, I think that it, you know, made me realize what I want for my children as well. So,
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for that perspective, Roger. Appreciate you calling up. And by the way, we have some open phone lines for you right now. Did your parents push you like Roger's father did? And how did it turn out? Was there a silver lining in that? Or do you kind of wish things had gone a different way? Did it cause you to make a different decision when you had your own children and decided, you know, I am not going to push the way mom or dad did? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email address is talk@WPR.org. And Brad, let's get your take on Roger's story.
Yeah, it seems like that's a case where his father really did want him to pursue the same path he had pursued. But Roger didn't have the same skill set as his father did, but nevertheless felt some pressure to do it anyway. And you know, I'm not sure. It's hard to know what impact that had on Roger. But it sounds like it's influenced his own parenting, that he's decided that he doesn't want to do that with his own children. So and would rather let them make their own choices.
You know, it's interesting because we do have some cultural assumptions about, you know, the way we should raise our children. And there was recently the Tiger Mom book out, and she said that is the way to go. You should push your children. You push your children because you love them. And, you know, other people say, no, you have to have a hands-off approach. And, you know, it can be confusing to know what is guidance and what is pushing and pursuing your own agenda.
Yeah, and I think encouraging is good. We should encourage our children to pursue whatever they want to do and provide them the support they need. But I honestly have no data, so I'm just speculating about the effect. But I can't imagine that, you know, like I have a black belt in Tung Soo Do, and our daughter and our son were both also taking Tung Soo Do. It's a Korean martial art. And, you know, our daughter was like 6 weeks away from getting her black belt, and she decided she didn't want to finish. And, you know, I encouraged her to finish. And but the motivation has to come from her. It can't come from me. It has to be her choice. And although, you know, we can encourage our children, we can't do it for them, and we can't force them to do it. And if we try, it seems like, at least my personal experience is, only bad comes from that. So,
How did you feel about her decision not to go for the black belt?
Well, I respected it. I mean, I did make a different decision for myself. I decided to pursue it myself, and, you know, but, I respected her choice and supported her in what she really wanted to do, which was theater. And so, you know, being a parent's tough.
Yeah.
It's an
understatement.
To be a researcher. Yeah, it's a lot easier to be a researcher than a parent, for sure.
Let's take another call now. We've got Jennifer with us from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Thank you for the show.
And sure.
I was just talking with my mother last night. Her and my dad were in town, and she's dealing with a lot of issues with her own mother and how she was raised, and she made a conscious decision to me and her sister in a different way, you know, really like open and supporting of whatever path we choose, and which is very different than how she feels she was raised. And it's made a really big difference. I see some stories.
Jennifer, we're kind of losing you there on your cell phone. But Brad, did you hear enough about that to comment?
Yeah. I wonder what kind of difference has it made. It sounds like it's made a positive difference. Is that right, Jennifer?
Yeah, I think Jennifer was saying it did make a positive difference. And
Yeah, I can't wait to do the next line of research and find out what the impact is on children and whether they feel pressure, because people generally, you know, I think they're, you know, a little bit of pressure is okay, but people, if the pressure becomes too extreme, you know, we know based on lots of research that performance suffers when pressure is too high. There's like an optimal level of pressure, just a little bit, but too much is not a good thing.
It's a hard line to walk.
Yeah, it is, for sure.
Well, obviously this research is very preliminary. You said you just sort of stuck your toe in these waters, but you're a dad, and I guess I'm wondering, based on what you found, are you going to change anything about the way that you parent? And got a little bit less than a minute here for your answer.
Yeah, I think I want my own children to be independent of me and be their own self and pursue their own dreams, and I'll try to encourage and support them in what they decide to do.
Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Brad Bushman is a professor of communication and psychology at Ohio State University. He's the co-author of a new study investigating why some parents push their kids.
Well, he's going to be doing more research in that, and so will we. We'll ask you to share your thoughts on whether you should push kids to do the things you succeeded or failed at. Go to the Central Time Facebook page. Share your thoughts, your stories, maybe even your advice for parents there. Coming up, we'll take a look at the decision in the George Zimmerman trial. That's coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Riggert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in the program, we'll begin our series on heroin in Wisconsin and the problems stemming from the drug.
But first, over the weekend, a verdict came down in the case against George Zimmerman, a former Neighborhood Watch volunteer accused of murdering 17-year-old Trayvon Martin.
After weeks of testimony and months of national media attention, Zimmerman was found not guilty by a six-person jury.
Joining us to discuss that verdict is Charles Rose, professor at Stetson University College of Law in Florida. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Now, let's start with the verdict. Was it a surprise to you?
Not at all. Right? It was not a surprise because of the nature of the way the case got to trial and the evidence that was actually presented.
Now, why did prosecutors opt to charge this as a second-degree murder?
Well, you'd have to ask the prosecutors why ultimately they made that decision, but it's easy to posit that there was at least some degree of political pressure. There's a very different feel to a manslaughter case as opposed to a murder case, because in manslaughter you don't need to prove intent in the state of Florida in the same fashion. And I think they believed the story that Mr. Zimmerman sought out Mr. Martin as a victim. The problem with that belief was it wasn't backed up by evidence.
Now, in the news, of course, this has been treated as a story about guns, about race, and about civil rights. When you get into a courtroom, how do you separate that out from just the facts before them and how they accord with the law?
Well, that's the judge's job. The attorneys push for the amount of emotion or issue to present before the jury based upon their theory of the case. The state wanted to get into profiling and to potentially raise the shadow of some sort of racial bigotry on the part of Mr. Zimmerman. The problem was they did not have the bona fides to put before the judge to get the judge to agree with them. So they were left with the argument that he profiled Trayvon Martin because he was wearing a hoodie and was walking through the neighborhood. And that's not that's nowhere near the concept that is in the minds of the public right now, that this was somehow racially motivated.
And the big thing here is that they have to prove a case beyond a shadow of a doubt, is what we hear from the courts, or at least the courts has presented on TV. Was that a tall order for the prosecution?
Well, beyond a reasonable doubt means that you don't have any doubt that's reasonable that the government has proved their case. And in this particular case, you wound up with exactly the opposite. The defense was able to literally prove that Mr. Zimmerman was acting in self-defense. So the pendulum swung about as far outside of the norm as a criminal trial goes.
Now, one of the big controversies here is over the Stand Your Ground law in Florida and in other states. Was that a factor in this verdict?
Well, it was a factor in the verdict in that the Stand Your Ground law, when the crime initially occurred, led police to know that they probably couldn't charge this case under the Stand Your Ground statute. It never actually played out at trial because the defense chose to raise self-defense instead of Stand Your Ground. Because if they'd raised Stand Your Ground, they would have had to do a pretrial hearing, and the state would have learned their entire theory of the case. and they didn't want to do that.
And were there issues with the initial investigation that made it hard to establish the facts for use in this trial?
No, actually, there were not. The initial investigation done by the local sheriff and the county supported what ultimately happened the day of trial. That statement has been made by the prosecutors who ultimately tried the case. What they're really saying is we didn't get to develop our evidence the way we wanted to. There was actually a greater problem with the involvement of civil attorneys on the part of the Martin family going out and getting witnesses, because civil attorneys don't understand criminal practice, and they contributed greatly to the embarrassment for that one young girl who was actually on the phone with Mr. Martin the day that he was shot, because by the time she got to trial, her testimony was useless.
Hmm. Now, I always wonder, in such high-profile cases, as they're interviewing jurors and both sides are trying to make sure they don't get somebody they don't want on that jury, how big a problem is that to get, I guess, untainted jurors on the court?
Jury selection is the most difficult thing that trial lawyers do in an average case, because you are literally talking to the folks who decide the issue completely and over whom you don't have control. When you add the emotional impact of the death of a child, and then on top of that, the racial turmoil within the nation as they look at this case from the outside, you're really, really worried about it. But we should be comfortable. This jury deliberated for over 16 hours. They went through every piece of evidence that was available. They worked through the statutes and ultimately came to a reasoned conclusion, whether you agree with it or not.
I think a lot of people in the country are looking to this case, however they looked at it, as a referendum somehow on gun laws or on race. Did that happen? Is there a referendum, or is this just a case that was a case itself?
I think it was very much about the self-defense laws in the nation and gun laws, and had very, very little to do with race. If we did not have Stand Your Ground in the state of Florida, the circumstances that led to these events turning out the way they did would have been very different.
Now, of course, this has been all over the national media. You're down there in Florida. How high profile has this been there, much less the rest of the country?
Well, I can tell you that I spent an hour and a half on a local television station the day this verdict came out explaining it to the public. It has been very highly watched and considered within the state.
And has this led to anybody saying, any likelihood that there will be changes in things like the Stand Your Ground law or how self-defense is treated in Florida law?
Well, the governor appointed a commission to review the Stand Your Ground law after this event occurred, when Mr. Martin was shot, but the commission ultimately came back with no major recommended changes.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to do it.
That was Charles Rose, professor at Stetson University College of Law.
Coming up next, it's a look at the severity of Wisconsin's heroin problem. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
A dangerous drug once thought to be relegated to the back alleys of Milwaukee or Chicago is reemerging as a serious problem for Wisconsin. In the first of Central Time's six-part series examining Wisconsin's heroin epidemic, Rich Kramer reports that the drug, which had fallen off the radar screen for many law enforcement agencies, is coming back strong and spreading through smaller rural parts of the state.
You know, it still smells like her in here, this sweet pea.
In Karen Hale's home in Hudson, a young girl's bedroom remains frozen in time. This is where her daughter, Alyssa Ivy, struggled with heroin addiction.
But you'll see, if I point it up, which is sad, you can see the blood spatter marks up on her ceilings. You know, you look up there.
From what?
Injecting, hitting the vein. That's what happens with heroin.
Alyssa died from an overdose at a nearby hotel in May. She was 21. Karen says she and her daughter put everything they had into fighting the addiction, but it wasn't enough.
Unfortunately, I lost in this battle, and a heroin won out, and I hate it for that. I hate the pain, and I still keep waiting for her to come home, but I know she's not ever coming home.
In the last 2 years, 7 people have died from an overdose of heroin in the Hudson area alone. According to the latest data, 134 people died the same way across the state in 2011. In 2007, 38 people died. So what's behind this epidemic? Department of Criminal Investigation Field Director Dave Spankowitz says it can be traced back to people's addiction to prescription painkillers. He says drugs like OxyContin have become extremely popular, but in recent years, doctors have been more careful prescribing them, and drug takebacks have kept them off the street.
So now you took all that source of supply. They're not in the medicine cabinets anymore. Doctors don't prescribe them as often. The cost. So all of a sudden, we're seeing people go to heroin because they had that level of addiction.
And Spackwitz says this drug is everywhere.
People have to realize that heroin is here and it's happening in their community. It's not a big city thing anymore. And people are dying as a result of their dealings with heroin.
While heroin is a problem in Milwaukee, Madison, and the Fox Valley, smaller, more rural communities are now faced with a drug epidemic they didn't expect. Dan Ault is police chief for the city of Oconto, which has a population of around 4,500 people. He says 2 weeks into his stint as police chief, people were finding syringes in parks, but there weren't any heroin arrests being made.
Heroin was, I believe, being missed. I think it was a lack of awareness that this drug had hit and how fast it hit the area.
About an hour to the west, Shawnee County saw the same trend. Heroin is now the drug that investigators are spending the most time on. And Sheriff's Department Captain Tom Tuma says heroin isn't a drug that discriminates.
There is no one socioeconomic group that this drug is unique to. This is a problem that truly crosses all borders and is insidious, and people of all walks of life and professions are finding themselves in trouble with.
DCI heroin expert Dave Spackwitz says police can't arrest their way out of the heroin epidemic. He says it will take more treatment and community support, even though budgets are tight. The State Department of Justice has announced a new initiative and grants to help local law enforcement fight heroin, but Spackwitz still expects the heroin problem to grow. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Rich for his reporting. And through the week and into Monday at this time, we will hear other reports on the state of heroin and how it's affecting us here in Wisconsin.
And here to talk with us about the heroin epidemic in rural Wisconsin is Sheriff Jerry Sove of Marinette County. Sheriff Sove, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you tell us about your experience with opiate use in Marinette County?
Well, we have a real issue with it here. I think it traces back to about 2007 when we had a doctor in Menominee who was eventually federally indicted and convicted, was doling out prescription medications, heavy doses of oxycodone and hydrocodone, those type of medications to people that really should not have been given them. I think that's where part of our problem started. When he went away, that source dried up. And a lot of these people turned to heroin use because it had become affordable and it was a replacement for that.
And do you have any idea, besides that doctor, why since then it has taken off in Marinette County?
Well, I think that was part of it. And then I think that it just became affordable and it became something that people tried. And then what we've learned is it's just so highly addictive that once people take it, they tell us, some of them, that they just have to have more and have to have more, and it becomes their life. And it's a type of drug that it is causes them such illness and just being sick if they don't get some more, and they don't want to feel like that, so they'll do just about anything to get some more.
Now, we know that the people don't function in vacuums. They're connected to networks of other people and to the community. What kind of challenges has this created in the community around Marinette County?
Well, it's been a real plague for us. It causes several issues for us. Number one, which I deal with a lot, we have a law enforcement center here in Marinette County that's 10 years old, and we built this facility. I did not think that we would have jail overcrowding issues, but we do. A lot of what we see are heroin people in our jail, and they're clogging up the system here. That's a big part of our issue. So we've got jail crowding issues. It's been a real challenge for our medical and emergency medical response people, where they have had to use this drug Narcan to bring several people back that would have otherwise died. The ER sees way too many people in there for abuse of opiates, and so the medical system is taxed. Our Health and Human Services, is also affected by dealing with the fallout from this, because these people get so wrapped up in this drug that they neglect their families, they neglect their children and even their pets at times, and it's really sad to see. And, of course, our coroner and our the people that deal with the bodies. I mean, that has been an issue also, because we certainly have had our share of overdoses.
Hmm. As sheriff of Marinette County, what is it that you're trying to do to try to combat the problem?
Well, we are making a commitment to keep personnel on the point of this drug effort and on point with the intelligence, and continuing to follow up on information that we do receive and to make cases. I'm certainly not flush on personnel here, but as long as I have something to say about it, I'm going to keep somebody on the point and working exclusively on this issue, because we know it's there and we know the collateral damage it causes. When we've seen so many terrible things as a result of this, not only property crime to support the habit, but the spinoff and the neglect of children. And to the point where we know that there have been instances of young women that have been willing to prostitute themselves to obtain funds to buy more drugs.
Hmm. Has it touched you personally at all beyond what you're seeing in your job?
No, fortunately, no one in my immediate family or anything has been affected by it. But I think what the public maybe doesn't understand about this issue is how expensive it is for us to continue to work. We are incurring overtime costs, court time. It's just a very expensive thing to investigate and continue to try and stay on top of. And, you know, if we're on top of it, perhaps we're on top of the tip of the iceberg, because there's certainly a lot of work to be done, and I could have a half a dozen more investigators working on this, and we could be going around the clock, and sometimes we do.
Have you made any inroads so far, or do you think the use is as high as it's ever been?
No, we certainly have. We're making cases all the time. We just recently took down some higher-level people, and that was an interstate investigation. And it's the type of thing where the public doesn't, if we clear up a string of burglaries, we can show the fruits of our efforts, if you will, much easier there. Say these people have been arrested as a result of these burglary investigations, but with this type of work, it is covert and undercover, and so often I can't make public who's been arrested because it affects the integrity of spinoff investigations.
Hmm. Well, what is the most important thing that you want people to know about heroin use?
I think it is that if anybody is intrigued by it and tempted to in a situation where there's a possibility to say, well, I'll just try it, don't do it, because we have seen and talked to a lot of people that said that one time, I wish I wouldn't have done it, because it is so highly addictive, and then it just starts controlling people's lives.
It seems like you've seen some heartbreaking things, and I'm guessing that dealing with the fallout from heroin use is not only difficult to see, but that it's preventing you from doing other work, too.
Yes, on both parts of your question. It is difficult to see what the families of these heroin people go through. It's painful to watch court proceedings when a judge is sentencing somebody to years in prison, and they're throwing their young life away, and watch parents, crying because they've done their best, and it's now they're watching somebody go to prison. And it's also very difficult to see how some of these people end up living and neglect children and so forth as a result of it. They just get consumed by it. And it's also one in which that, if I didn't have this, we could certainly turn our efforts towards other type of law enforcement efforts that need attention also.
Well, Sheriff Sauve, I wish you well, and thank you so much for joining us on Central Time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Marinette County Sheriff Jerry Sauve. Coming up tomorrow, as we continue this series on heroin in Wisconsin, we'll hear about the role that prescription drugs play in the state's heroin epidemic.
And don't forget, you can keep up with us, find out what we'll be covering, and leave your thoughts at the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about racial divisions in the United States in the aftermath of the George Zimmerman trial.
And we'll look at an effort by Sesame Street to help kids whose parents are in prison or jail. One of the main consultants on that is a UW-Madison professor. She'll be here to tell us what kind of help kids need and how to talk to kids whose parents are incarcerated, who are in jail or are in prison.
And another thing we'll be looking at tomorrow is the trend nationally for grandparents to have a huge hand in helping to raise the kids. I know that's a case in my family. Mm-hmm. I think it's in the case in yours
in
as well,
too.
Rob. So this is not just us, though. This is a national trend. We'll be looking at that and finding out what's happening and how the American family is changing around it.
And then we're going to have some fun and talk about tattoos, a new museum exhibit, and we're hoping to hear about your ink. So that's all coming up tomorrow. Right here on Central Time, here in the Ideas Network.